Welcome to day three of the Stanza Poetry Festival podcast. On this episode, we've got excerpts from some really outstanding events. This includes an interview with and poetry from Swiss-based sound outfit Trio Palundi, a chance to hear from Stanza lecturer Jay Perini on his memories of Alistair Reid and Jorge Luis Borges. Excerpts from today's Poetry Breakfast on the state of Scottish poetry, including Stuart Kelly and Roddy Lumsden, experimental poetry from Peter McCary, and finally, a Dalek love song. But we start off with an excerpt from this year's Stanza lecture given by Jay Perini, and he entitled it Homecoming in Poetry. And in this excerpt, he discusses his experience of being in St Andrews in the late 60s and early 70s, and specifically his experience with a number of poets. But I'll leave it for Jay to introduce them.
There was in Scotland, I think during those years, a kind of revival of poetry. I did my best to meet and sit at the feet of various poets that I admired, including Hugh McDermott and George Mackay Brown. The latter in particular meant a great deal to me. With a friend from St. Andrews, Chris Payne, I made a pilgrimage across the Pentland Firth to Orkney, where George met us at the ferry, his jaw jutting forward, his eyes shining, his wild hair blowing as it did in the stiff wind. We moved quickly to a warm pub in Kirkwall. I remember the particular journey because I was so seasick all the way over on the boat. I loved Orkney with its bare landscape, and I loved George Mackay Brown's poems and stories. These lyrical stories of his live in my head to this day, and the bare, beautiful landscape of Orkney seemed a complete world in his fiction and poems, the equivalent of Faulkner's Yaknapatawpha County, Steinbeck's Monterey, or Robert Frost's area north of Boston. Each of these locales became a discrete universe for the writer working in it, a place where the author could explore the human condition in all of its vastness and strangeness while giving, quote, a local habitation and a name to feelings that we all have. But I'm going to backtrack now to Alistair Reid. I had a tutor in history, Anne Wright. She was the daughter of Johnny Wright, who was the professor of moral philosophy here for decades. Remember Johnny Wright? Marvelous man. He used to go swimming in the North Sea year-round. Wonderful fellow. And I was having a tutorial in British history with Anne in Hamilton Hall, and she said to me after we got really bored, she said, "Tell me, Mr. Perini, what do you want to do with your life?" I said, "Well, I want to write poetry." She said, "Ooh." She said, "I don't know about that." She said, "In any case, you'd better talk to Alistair." And she phoned him right on the phone, this is about 1970 sometime, and said, "Alistair, there's a young man, an American, who wants to write poetry." Silence on the line. And she said, hung up, she said, "Alistair said he'll meet you tomorrow at noon in the Central Tavern." So I went up to Alistair, and I still remember that day nervously going into the Central Tavern and seeing Alistair hunched over the bar. I could tell who he was. And I said up to him, I said, "Mr. Reid," he said, "so you're the one." He said to me, "All right," he said, "are you serious about writing poems?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you have any with you?" I said, "Yes, I just happened to have brought something." He read my poem, and he said, "All right," he said, "if you're serious," he said, "I want you to come out to Pillmore Cottage on the old course where I live every day at 4 o'clock. I said, "Every day at 4 o'clock?" He said, "Yes, and bring a poem with you, a new one, every day at 4 o'clock. He said, "We'll see how long this will last." So I, next day, pedaled out there on my bicycle and put my poem down. Alistair said, "All right," he said, "I will correct your poem." I thought, "Correct my poem." And I sat down, and Alistair just, you know, suddenly he would cross out words and circle stanzas and just cross things out and move things around silently. And he said, "You know," he said, I'm doing this because afterward I was a little shocked. And it really could see I was learning a great deal. He said, "I did this with Graves." He said, "When I was a student at St. Andrews, I wrote to Robert Graves and said, I'm a student of Latin and Greek at St. Andrews, and I'm just graduating, and I want to come to Spain, and I want to show you, and come to my Mallorca, and I want to show you some of my poems." And Graves wrote back and said, "Actually, I need some help. I've just been commissioned by Penguins to translate the Lives of the Noble Caesars, Suetonius, and if you could give me a rough draft. So Alistair made straight off from Mallorca. He wound up staying 3 years there, living in a little cottage in the basement of the field, at the base of the field. And he would go up, and he said the first time he went with his translations, he put pages down in front of Graves, and Graves said, "All right, I'll correct you." And he silently sat there, and Alistair said he was stunned as he saw, you know, adjectives disappeared as they were sort of swallowed into stronger nouns, and adverbs lopped off as they became absorbed into stronger verbs. And he could see the syntax, you know, switched from passive into active, and the whole thing becoming bright and sparkling and fresh. And Alistair said he really learned to write by sitting with Graves and showing Graves his poems and having Graves correct him. And I came again and again back to Alistair. I don't know how long it lasted, but actually, to be quite frank, 3 weeks ago, I went into Greenwich Village with a new poem, and I sat at the kitchen table and let 84-year-old Alistair correct me. So it goes on and on. There's no end of this. So Alistair was translating the poet Borges at the time, and at one point he said to me, this is like spring of 1971 or something, I forget the date exactly, he said, "Borges is coming to work on some translations." And I said, "Oh, good." I've never heard of Borges, frankly. Meant nothing to me. And Alistair, oh, he's a great Argentine writer. I was very dismissive at this idea of this great Argentine writer. And I went out the first night to Alistair's for dinner and met Borges. And he was totally blind, and he stood there like this, pontificating the whole time he talked. Rambling, it seemed to me, but interesting. And remember, he said to me, "I'm so delighted to be in Scotland, the home of my favorite poet, Robert Louis Stevenson." You know, and he quoted, "This be the verse you gave for me. Here he lies where he longed to be. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter, home from the hills." I was amazed how much Borges could recite by memory. In fact, I can remember very much going out outside of Alistair's house with him one day, and he said to me, "Do you know the greatest poem?" I said, "What is the greatest poem, Mr. Borges?" He said, "Don't call me Mr. Borges. Borges, what's the greatest poem?" He said, "Among School Children, William Butler Yeats." He quoted the whole thing. I could still see him with his trembling hand, you know. It was amazing to see how you know, "Labor is blossoming or dancing where the body is not bruised, the pleasure soul, da 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 da. O chestnut tree, great rooted blossomer, are you the beech, the blossom, or the bole? O body swayed to music, O brightening glance, how can we know the dancer from the dance?" And that stayed in my mind all these years hearing Borges say this. Well, Alistair one day calls up and he says, "Jay, I've suddenly been called to London. I must be gone. Can you babysit Borges?" And I said, "Oh, God. I'm not good with old people." But I went out there. I borrowed a car from a friend because Borges said to me, he said, "I want to see a bit of Scotland." But very interesting for a blind man. But so I took him in Peter Edbury's car out along the East Nook, out to Crail and Anstruther. And I said, "Is there anything particular you'd like to do out here, Borges?" He said, "Yes." He said, "I want to go to a Scottish pub." He said, "In Scotland, it's supposed to be serious business." And we found this pub with a sawdust floor on it. And I took him down the stairs here, and I sat him down, and I said, "What would you like?" He said, "A pint of the local beer." I brought it to him, and he smelled it. I can see his little face there. Blew the foam off it, took a drink. Licked his lips. He was really enjoying himself. And I conversed, he didn't say anything, and I waited and waited, and I said, "So, Alistair tells me you're a writer." "What would you say, you know?" And he said, "Oh," he said, "Alistair's always exaggerating." So I said, "Well, Borges, not to be too inquisitive, but have you written a novel?" He said, "Oh, no." I said, "You've never written a novel?" "Oh, never." I said, "Well, what you?" He said, "I've only written very little stories, very small stories. They're gone in a blink. Some of them are one paragraph." I said, "Really?" I was very dismissive. I said, "Well, Borges," I said, "we can speak frankly as friends." I said, "Did you ever want to write a novel?" I said, "Really? Oh, I saw you, Jay. My life," he said, "decades upon decades, I dreamt of a great epic novel. It would be 1,000 pages long, maybe 2,000. There would be it would be an epic of the pampas. There would be generations of men and women, fathers and sons, children and grandchildren. There would be gauchos, and there would be prostitutes, lots of prostitutes. There would be knife fights. There would be matricide. And there would be parricide." He said, "But nothing came." And he said, "One morning, after 3 or 4 decades of this going on in my head, I woke up and I went to my desk and I wrote a 200-word review of this novel." He said, "And that satisfied the impulse."
And we'll be posting the full audio from Jay's lecture at the end of the festival. We now have Glasgow-born but Swiss-based poet Peter McCary with a selection from his astounding web-based project, The Syllabary, which can be found at thesyllabary.com. We're going to include a couple of excerpts from his website, which are slightly difficult to explain, so we'll let the poems do the explaining. And if you want more information about them, go on to the website.
High table. Desks grumble. Class rises for the guest. In Soviet car plants, where deaths were factored into personal debts, steel was siphoned into skillets, clutch plates came out as dense as osteoporotic delft. He decks the pedal and the brake, surprise, surprise, dents in the bumper, abrasive roadkill. Deaths for dinner, darling, one ought to dress. That I should take your name in vain to the christening stars of every blooming year is the fortunate, the unfortunate thing. St. Brendan's skull turned turtle as the sea withdrew in a sharp intake of breath. Between West 3rd and East 4th Streets, so high and dry, but don't you fear, it's coming back. I was there with the Shahs of Shiraz, with the shamans and shams of Siberia, sat on the red rugs and shags and the red rubble shards of the high road. Just one of the cupbearers hadn't attracted their ribaldry. Such beauty and force, how could they not have noticed at all? I lifted a glass. She approached, and I covered its rim. "Would you do me a favour?" She waited. "Stay just as you are forever," she looked. The rest of the scene disappeared. Society, sex, the red carpet, my language and bearing. "Forever," she said, "in your memory," turned on her heel. Now I'm tired of this tankard that brims as soon as I drain it. I was there with the Shahs of Shiraz, with the shamans and shams of Siberia, sat on the red rugs and shags, in the red rubble shards of the high road.
And if you want to see more of Peter McCary's work, then go to thesyllabary.com. We move on to excerpts from this morning's Poetry Breakfast, which pose the question, what is the state of current Scottish poetry, especially poets under the age of 40? Stuart Kelly, the literary editor of Scotland on Sunday, started off the proceedings.
I suppose I should be a bit of an old Marxist about this. Why do people write to make money? You don't make much money out of poetry. If you're in an MLit course, are you going to go for the novel, where you get the £10,000 advance, or the poetry collection, where you're lucky to get £2,000? In terms of the publishing structure, we've got that problem as well. There are fewer publishers of poetry. And I'm not really talking about full collections so much as magazines. When I came back to Scotland from university, there were 30 Scottish literary magazines. There's now maybe 5. So the seedbed idea of where young poets come from is completely missing. I suppose I should take my own blame in this as well. You know, as critics, we have a role of promoting it. Now, I can't review books that don't exist. At the same time, when we do get poetry books through, it's rather difficult to review them in newspapers. You know, you need a big space to explain why somebody's a good poet. You know, that's compared to novels or non-fiction, reviewing is much more difficult. Does it actually matter? Well, I'm less sure about that one. I think there probably are some great poets out there. What there doesn't seem to be is dangerous poets. I remember meeting an old woman at university who remembered reading T.S. Eliot for the first time, and her reaction was, "This isn't poetry. You know, this is so utterly different. This is so completely out of the box." I don't get that feeling from a lot of the poetry I read. A lot of it seems quite predictable. I don't see a generation that is saying, let's knock down those idols. Let's say Edwin Morgan's aesthetic is completely what we don't want to do. So that kind of danger, I think, is missing. I think it is about, you know, where are the readers of poetry rather than the writers. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, I mean, I go to a lot of literary events, I go to a lot of readings. I was speaking to a friend after one reading who said, you know, it's a bit like these Cambridge undergraduates that fell under the sway of Ruskin, that could do very competent watercolours, but we're all looking for the Picasso. And we just sat down and sort of ran through the kind of signs of that competent kind of poetry. You know, the gerund of opening, standing, you know, at the window, looking from the train. The use of quite a lot. So you get things like an architecture of webs or a whisper of blossom. That's a very kind of competent kind of poetry. Also, yoking together the abstract and the concrete. You see a lot of that. People talk about, you know, the metaphysical loam or the ephemeral twigs. And a kind of tentative morality. People don't like to say, this is the case. They say, maybe it was that, or perhaps I felt, or, you know, that kind of tentative sense of it. So you can get these very competent things that look like poems, smell like poems, but somehow lack that dangerous spark.
Next up was St Andrews-born poet Roddy Lumsden.
It doesn't matter. For me, it does matter. I think it's odd, and I kind of look under me and want to see what went wrong or if something went wrong. The Gregory statistics are as follows. In the past 30 years, there have been 30 Eric Gregory Award winners from Scotland. But there's an odd thing that in the last 15 years, there have been none. In the previous 15 years, there were 15. So it falls into that very, very odd pattern. And could it be by chance? It might be. I've given a lot of thought to this, and I don't know why. Could it be stuff to do with education, publishing, infrastructure? Perhaps, and we'll try and establish that, I guess, during this discussion.
Next up was Shetland poet Christy Williamson, who decided to read a poem.
These are translations of Garcia Lorca into Shetland. And these actually started happening because of a theatre production that I was taking part in. Anyway, I'll read this one. It's called The Unfaithful Wife. And I took her to the burn, thinking she wasn't spoken for, but she had a man. It was St. James's Nicht, and I but the nicht for it. The lamps was slockit, and the crickets blinkit. At the edge of the tune, I touched her sleeping paps, and they opened suddenly like petals of hyacinths. The starch of her cots sounded in me lugs like a piece of silk rived between tullies. Athoot the cellar licht abound them, the trees was looming lang, and our horizon the dugs, yalket, gae far for the burn. Yon by the brambles, the hawthorns and the siggies, I made a denky in the sand and under her bush of hair. I took off me tie, sure took off her frock. Aye, me gun belt, sure her power bodices. Neither roses nor shells hae skin as fine as hers, nor the crystals of the moon glance with sickened brilliance. Her hawks slither for me like flegget fish, e half full lowing, the tither half penishing. That nicht I galloped on the main rods on the middle of Peril Mare, we neither bind nor stirrup. I maunna say as a man the things she said to me. The licht o' Canaan has made me car canny. Clerted wi' smurricans and sand, I took her for the burn. Fechting wi' the air was the swords o' siggies. I could only be mysel, like a true gypsy. I gied her a muckle shoeing box of stray-coloured satin. I didna want to far for her, cos she had a man, and telt me she wasna spoken for when I took her to the burn.
Christy then responded in his own way to the question that was posed for the discussion.
I think there are a lot of young poets out there, but I think the publishing landscape is pretty difficult for young poets. I think a lot of poets exist in the spoken word environment that I don't know who they are. There must be poets out there. I'm sure a lot of them are under 40. Finding publications to appear in is difficult. I mean, my perspective is I'm from Shetland. Definitely the first magazine I was in was The New Shetlander.
And finally, we have Juliet Rees from the Scottish Poetry Library.
I think we do a lot of other work with young people, mainly in filmmaking. And I got to thinking about this, and I was thinking that on the one hand, I meet a lot of young people through the formal education sector where poetry is part of schoolwork, and writing poems and reading poems is part of schoolwork. And it's a very different thing to when I meet people involved in extracurricular activities, and they have been lately, they've been mainly filmmaking. These young people, they are writing poetry, but it's not what they're showing to people, and it's not what they're sharing with people, and it's not the end result. And I think it's something to do with what Stuart was saying, that they will occasionally show me things, and they're writing poetry as part of their creative process and part of their the method with which they're exploring their ideas and language, and also exploring their senses and their experience of the world. But then that's all channeled into something else. It's not the end result somehow. And I don't know whether that's just because it's a private thing at this stage, and perhaps it's also part of this understanding that they won't make money out of that, so they'll use it and they'll explore it and they'll enjoy it privately. But at the moment, they want to find a job, and they go, so they will put that creativity will then be used in another way.
We now have something quite unusual in the form of sound poetry from Switzerland, in the form of a piece called Which Language by Trio Palundi, who are Heike Fiedler, Alexa Montani, and Marina Salzmann.
Which language do you speak? Which language do you speak? Do you cook? Do you play? Do you see? Do you hide? Do you want? Do you mean? Do you search? Do you fuck? Do you touch? Do you eat? Do you think? Do you cry? Do you suggest? Do you do? Do you deny? Did you lose? Do you? Are you do? Do you fear? Do you know? Does your making act makes you being free? Do you fear? Do you hold? Makes you die? Which language? Sprichst du? Kochst du? Spielst du? Siehst du? Steckst du? Willst du? Meinst du? Suchst du? Fuck you? Fühlst du? Isst du? Denkst du? Schreist du? Hörst du? Schlägst du? Tust du? Verneinst du? Hast du? Verlierst du? Bist du? Fühlst du? Kennst du? Hältst du? Mach dich an? Lässt dich handeln? Mach dich frei? Hältst du? Töte dich? Which language? Parles-tu, cuisines-tu, joues-tu, vois-tu, caches-tu, aimes-tu, veux-tu, dis-tu, cherches-tu, baisses-tu, touches-tu, manges, tu penses-tu, cries-tu, entends-tu, fais-tu, dénonces-tu, as-tu perdu, es-tu, sens-tu, connais-tu, te souviens-tu, te pousses, te fais agir, te libères, as-tu confondu, crains-tu, te tues, retiens-tu, te dis-tu, d'où, oui, I caught up with Trio Palundi after their performance and asked them a few questions about sound poetry. And the first thing I was interested in was it because they were from Switzerland that they layered different languages and different techniques in order to create poetry?
I think it's because all of us, we speak
several languages, and it's not dependent to the fact if it's in Switzerland or not, because I, for myself, I'm not from Switzerland.
Oh, okay.
I'm from Germany. I live there now. But I think she speaks several languages, Marina, and myself too, so
right.
That was just something mostly coming on like this.
I think the different languages are also with the subject identity, which is something present in Geneva, and we this subject we wanted to work about.
Mm-hmm.
So. Right. It's identity and our identity, because we are all cut by languages, traversé, I don't know how to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Languages go through us all the time, and we hear very many languages all the time. And it has something to do about identity of the world too, of being part of the world. But, and I think we are the three of us, not because we want to make explode this I, this lyrical ego about which you just spoke, but because we are trying to make something with the sound, simply, and to make this thing with the sound and to make this work, and this kind of searching of what sound can be, it's interesting to be three different persons. Because I think actually that in good poetry, the lyrical ego explodes every time. A good poem, probably, is something that can be taken by everyone that listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to be many to make it explode. It explodes all the time.
For me, what was important in the approach that we are three persons, three voices, is also the point of view of bringing together stuff. It's to make it more open, this I, poetic I, no? Because I think very often it's something that is very enclosed by itself. And so when we take the text and we improvise with it, this is something that is tending to open poetry, to open the mind, to open sounds, and also to interact
yes,
in an interesting
right.
way. This is very important, I think, this question of improvisation. Indeed, we have many structures, but there is also a file of a big liberty, which is also behind, beside the question of identity, an important point. Yeah, and in the ground and the basis, there is always a text, just for the real sound, without words, no?
Okay.
So there is also a fluctuation from text to deconstruction, sounds, and re-going to the text and the world.
We are more working with the sounds, and it's not jazz, it's not a still of jazz, but with the sounds of the words, with the sounds of the vocals,
mm-hmm.
or consonants.
Experiencing a Chio Palundi's set was something quite remarkable, and it's the sort of thing that you really sort of have to attend in order to get the effect. But we hope we gave you something of a flavour of what it was like to be there, and also something of the ideas behind what it is they're trying to achieve. We'll end this podcast with a poem by the Edinburgh-based poet Kevin Cadwallader, which is a sound poem of an altogether different kind, and certainly brought back memories for me of hiding behind the sofa.
I wrote this in Cumbria when I was a resident poet over there for the early morning breakfast show to wake people up. So it's called Red Daleks Love Song.
You will promise to love, honour and obey. We will marry on the home planet. You will promise to obey. We will be happy. That is an order. You will obey. You will obey. I will buy you a bungalow in Wester Hales, and you will exterminate all germs from our bungalow. I will buy you domestos from the supermarket, and many other cleaning utensils and kitchen appliances. You will obey. You will obey. I will sing your strange earth songs with you, because I too want to have sex on the beach. Although I do not have a human member or an orifice or logger, I will be a techno Dalek. I will sing to you. I've noticed you around. I find you very attractive. Will you go to bed with me? I have my own
Just after reading this poem, Kevin Cadwallader wandered into a blue police box that was situated in the garden of the Bar Theatre, and I didn't see him for the rest of the day. Well, that's it for day 3 of the Stanza Festival podcast. We hope that you've enjoyed what we've offered on this particular episode, and we'll be back tomorrow night with more excitements from the Bar Theatre in St Andrews. Thanks very much to Ewan McLean for his music that features at the start of this podcast, and to Jill Bowman for her rendition of the Burns track The Deal of the Wild with the Excise Man, which leads us out. Thanks very much for listening.